Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome you to Radiology Across Borders podcast series, The Rabcasts. In the next 30 minutes, we will be interviewing a leader in their field of expertise, an individual who, through their skills, has had a significant impact both locally and globally, and in many cases has shaped that conversation. My name is Suresh De Silva. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. In this third edition of the Rabcast for 2023, we are delighted to welcome Dr. Shrey Varana, Chief Executive Officer at IMED Radiology Network. IMED Radiology is Australia's largest medical imaging network, offering comprehensive diagnostic imaging services. Shrey joined IMED in 2020 after relocating from South Africa, where he practiced as a medical director and then chaired and was a CEO on the board of directors of several radiology businesses and hospital groups across Europe and Asia. He was formerly a partner with McKinsey's, responsible for the healthcare practice in Africa, as well as CEO of Life Healthcare Group. Shrey also worked as a military doctor and managed clinics for the Defence Forces. Through Shrey's leadership and commitment to education, IMED continues to partner and support radiology across borders and have been since 2018. Shrey has a strong track record in healthcare management, in operations and strategic development. Shrey, welcome to the Rabcasts.
Thank you for having me, Suresh. I'm excited to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you, and also on a personal level, I'd like to thank IMED for being our foundation imaging partner back in 2018 and continuing that support now. And we're delighted to be able to talk to you about many things, hopefully tonight, and also to find out a little bit more about IMED. So let's get stuck into it. Shrey, as I was saying, IMED are our major partner of the charity, along with several others, but you have been the foundation imaging partner and were that partner since 2018. We have much benefit from the support of IMED in many ways, including the financial support. You personally are passionate about philanthropy. Can I ask you to tell us a little bit more about why IMED is so committed to helping in developing nations and why you on a personal level are?
Suresh, for me, I'm a big believer that health, education, and then and not to ever say economic reform, because that's slightly more tangential at a systems level, are probably the three cornerstones of the things, if we get right, will shift society and humanity for the better. And I just grew up with a set of parents and in a home where there's always a strong sense of community and social contribution. And so, you know, every part of my career and the corporations that I've, you know, been blessed and fortunate enough to work with have always had a strong sense of purpose. And it's interesting you mentioned health and through RAB education, but those are my two passion topics. And so both for me personally, but also for IMED, we do recognize that whenever we have the opportunity, and for me personally, whenever I have the opportunity, the ability to invest time, and so not just money, time and money that can help, you know, improve the health and well-being of people around the world. It's just such an important thing to do.
Mm. And I guess the industry that we're in really fits in very nicely with that, doesn't it? So essential.
I think healthcare absolutely lends itself to that. I think you know, I'm always surprised for people who join healthcare without a strong sense of purpose, because it is one of those industries where you are driven by how can we help others. And I think radiology within that, even more so, you know, angles in on that because of its ability to provide, you know, earlier diagnosis and fundamentally change people's lives, particularly around some serious illnesses and diseases.
We have to be, let's be honest about that. If you don't have good radiology, you don't have good healthcare. Okay, everything is based around radiology, so it's important to get that initial step right. Shrey, IMED is Australia's largest diagnostic imaging network and one of the largest in the world, if I'm not incorrect. We have over 240 clinics located in metropolitan, as well as many regional communities across Australia. And I believe you've also expanded into New Zealand. IMED Radiology's team comprises over 4,000 people, including 315 radiologists. Each year across the network, you perform more than 5 million patient procedures. This is probably a difficult question without one simple answer, but what do you attribute this success to?
Our staff, our doctors, and a deep sense of putting the patient first. You know, I think you've described a lot around its size. Mm-hmm. And for me, I would rather we spoke about success in terms of the impact we're having on health outcomes mm-hmm. in society. You know, we often reference that we serve 23 to 24%, probably even more of that, of all of radiology in Australia. And for me, that's more about the responsibility we have in providing high quality healthcare mm-hmm. and working with our referrers in terms of helping shift the health and well-being of the patients. That to me is the success that I would say we're achieving or hopefully are achieving. And I would attribute that to the people in the business. Mm-hmm. You know?
Okay. You are quoted as saying that you learn to appreciate the few teachers who, in the criticism of you and the belief that you would not amount to much, taught you to step up and accept a challenge and prove people wrong. What are the inspirations that drove Shrey Varana to succeed and to be the person he is today?
First, I think important context on that quote. You've clearly done your research. I have to admit, I was quite naughty as a schoolboy. I'd like to believe I've outgrown it, which might be why those teachers had that view of me in their defense. But I've always been driven by a challenge. I think, for me, what inspires and motivates me and drives me to succeed, I think a strong sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. And that's why I work in healthcare. I attribute a lot of that to the family environment I grew up in, where I grew up with parents who had a strong sense of community. And, what do we do that's helping make people's lives easier and better? So I think that's a lot. I think a large part of it is also around integrity, which is always acting. And I often openly say, what is the right thing to do here? And I think that's important to me in terms of what drives me is what is the right thing to do and are we acting with purpose? And then I have to admit it, I do enjoy a challenge. Mm-hmm. Being told I can't achieve something or something can't be done is typically the moment I sit up and go, okay, let me give this a try. and that's not in an arrogant way. I hope it doesn't come across in that sense. But I'm driven by the desire to see if we can achieve more and do more. Mm-hmm. And probably not so much by fear of failure. And if we get it wrong, I see it as how do we learn and how do we try again? Mm-hmm. And so my willingness to take on challenges and try is definitely that and purpose are the two things that motivate me the most. I'm a big believer in courage, gratitude, and kindness. Those are my three mantra words.
So no mountain is too high, no challenge is too high, too difficult.
It might be initially, but mm-hmm. with the right level of thinking and planning, it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Look, leading on from that point, I think that leads into this question really well. In 2018, only 3% of CEOs in Australia were of a non-Anglo-Celtic background. And in 2022, only 6 of 500 CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies were people of colour. Now, I think it's fair to say, and I know that with the audience that we reach, this is a really important question for them, that you're one of the few people who have broken that glass ceiling. What would you say to any person of colour or Asian background or anyone who's a minority who aspires to achieve what you have but may worry about the barriers that may be placed in front of them?
I think my answer to this, Suresh, obviously is contextualised and framed by my journey because mm-hmm. I know these kind of topics, it'd be remiss of me to speak more broadly or on behalf of others' perspectives. And I know yes. people are very diverse in their thinking on this. From my learning, my guidance would be, one, check whether there really is a glass ceiling or how much of that is perception. So I often go, I can't change others, I can change myself. And so that's been my approach to a lot of it. And so what I found is, rather than seeing obstacles, I've reframed these as opportunities and challenges. And so this may sound relatively simplistic, and I hope not cliched, but counterintuitive to how many other people might experience it. And I've now probably worked in probably 7-8 countries or more. And so I say this with quite a broad frame beyond Australia. Hard work, mm-hmm. grit, determination, a sense of integrity and doing the right thing, mm-hmm. and being motivated by purpose tends to either drive success or allows you to assimilate with other people who are like-minded. And so you tend to find similarity in like-minded humans, despite on our phenotype, you know, our ethnicity, our orientation, gender, sexuality, and other things, we may see difference. My experience has been there's so much commonality amongst humans that when, you know, hardworking, intelligent, driven people tend to surround each other and support each other. And then, you know, glass ceilings can, in my experience, we presuppose they're there and actually you can overcome. But then again, that's been my journey. And so it's misperceived. Because there are a lot of good people who will back and support you. And on occasion, there may be a context where it is valid and it is relevant because I don't want to diminish somebody else's journey. And in that case, people should make personal choices about, in the context of where they are, does it feel right for them, you know? I've used a biology example previously when I've answered this and it's landed poorly. Let me just upfront say that. So let me, in the context of this being more medical and healthcare inclined, it may land badly. And I hope it's not a controversial view, but it is a sincere view of mine. It's my truth, which is, like in biology, there's a host organism in a foreign body. And when you come into an organization, you have to have the humility to realize that they are the host organism and I am new to it and foreign. And the humility to appreciate that and try to find ways to fit into that organization's, its culture. And obviously there may be things that may need to change, good or bad, but generally respecting and knowing that you're a host in someone else's space actually also goes a long way. And you know, that may resonate with some people, it may not resonate with others, but I found that when you earn the right, it then creates the space to be yourself and people always embrace you. That's been my journey.
Look, I think that is a really terrific bit of advice in terms of the hard work and the integrity, but also the way that you describe the biology to me is what I call compromise. And you need to accept the environment you're going into, but bring the best of you into that environment. And combination of those things can help you break that glass ceiling. So I think that's a really good bit of advice for any of people who, you know, may be thinking about the difficulties and trying to counter that. Leading on from that question, have you noticed any differences for you in the work environment in Australia compared to South Africa or elsewhere? And what are some of the positives that you see in Australia and some of the things that we can do better here?
Definitely have observed some differences. I think the most one that stands out and probably feels obvious to many of your listeners is one of the things Australia has done incredibly well, and not just South Africa, but compared to most countries in the world, you know, you can count the number of countries that have got well-established and well-funded health systems. And I'm sure for many people living in Australia with their context being local, they may not feel that. But at a global level, this is, you know, without doubt, one of the better funded and better structured and well-functioning health systems. And I don't just mean that versus developing countries. I say that even when I compare it to most developed countries, right? And so that's one thing that's been done really well. And credit to the people who had the foresight to plan for it. If I think about the thing that could be done better, and I say this humbly because, you know, I've been here now just under 4 years, of which a large part of that was skewed by the realities of what the world went through in 2021. So I may have a different lens. But if I think about it, you know, I always go back to healthcare is about society, right? And if I go back to that, access to care and affordability are always top of mind for me. I think we've done a phenomenal job on quality. And while we should never drop that bar, I do, when I take a forward-looking view for Australia, but also when you take a global view on the realities of healthcare becoming unaffordable in most of the developed world. Again, let's, you know, separate these out. The lens around how we, and this isn't just the regulators or politicians or government officials, but how we collectively as custodians of the health system need to think about, you know, helping innovate to create greater access to care and making healthcare more affordable is probably the one thing I think, as I think ahead, we will need to do better. I've been surprised by And I don't know the root cause of it, but I've been surprised by how we're so good at health, intervening, treating health issues and disease, and how we've maybe either consciously or otherwise chosen to potentially underinvest in earlier health promotion, health prevention, wellness, and screening. Mm. And I think about chronic disease and cancer being 50% of, you know, the burden. I do wonder whether we've underinvested versus some of the other countries. And that might be something that actually takes the pressure off the downstream effects on people and in terms of improving the health outcomes.
Now, I think what you talk about, primary prevention, is becoming more and more important. And the point that you alluded to about the healthcare system being here, being a good system, in terms of mortality, Australia is only second to Japan in terms of life expectancy for males and females, which is quite astounding when you know, comparing it to a lot of countries. But yeah, you're right. If we can introduce that primary healthcare, even with cardiac CT, you know, simple things like that, we can potentially extend that even further. Maybe even pip Japan, who knows?
No, and that's right. I do think it, particularly the three big chronic diseases all linked to cardiovascular risk and cancer. Mm. You know, some of the programs, and there are some amazing programs that are done really well in this country, like, for example, breast screening. But I think if I expand it beyond that, it does feel like there's an opportunity to much more earlier intervene and shift health outcomes, which would fundamentally shift both access and quality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, leading on from that, this is, you know, this is the topic that everyone has some engagement with or is affected by, and that is artificial intelligence. Now, artificial intelligence for radiologists is helping us in certain ways in terms of, you know, speeding up our reporting and such. One thing that I've noticed, though, from my point of view, and this is a personal take, is that it hasn't yet got to the point where it's showing me things that I can't see as a radiologist yet, okay? Where I think it's going to be amazing, and it already is in developing nations. Now, if we look at Papua New Guinea, our closest neighbor, which I visited, there are 8 to 9 million people and there are three radiologists. You know, Cook Islands, no radiologists. Now, the countries where there's a dearth of radiologists will benefit incredibly from artificial intelligence. Now, you're a leader in this area and I very much value your viewpoint on AI. And I'm going to ask you this straight up. Do you really think it will be the holy grail many in the industry hope it will be?
It's a great question. I think it's never good form, particularly on a podcast, to respond to a question with a question, which is it would depend on what we define as the Holy Grail, right? Mm-hmm. I think here's my intuitive sense, and I would separate out the clinical uses of AI, as in where it's used as a complementary tool in imaging, like you're referring to non-clinical spaces, right? And happy to talk about both if we have enough time. But for me personally, I think the answer will absolutely be segmented on a socioeconomic lens or access to a radiologist lens, which is effectively often the same thing, because we do have a global shortage of radiologists. So I think in emerging markets or developing countries, it's exactly what you described. Being able to put the steel down, the hardware down, build a bricks and mortar clinic, we can do. There's not a shortage that's incredibly sensitive of me to just presume there's not a shortage of funding for that, but historically that's not been the rate limiting step. Getting a radiologist into many of those countries has been the challenge, and having the AI tools there to complement, you know, generalist physicians, medical officers, ED physicians will provide improved quality until we get the health systems to work where, from a human resources for health point of view, we can train and get enough people in. And that's a long way off, and it's been a conversation we've been having for decades. So I'm being very pragmatic about the role of technology, particularly in developing and emerging countries, including AI, which has been fundamental in terms of changing health outcomes for people. I think in developed countries where there is still a shortage of clinicians, the ability to use it as a complementary tool, where some doctors might find it useful to kind of pre-populate or give them something or give them a second read, you know, could be quite useful. And as we spoke about earlier, when we start to think about screening, it could, with the right level of clinical governance and the right level of audit and control, could become an effective screening environment for certain diseases where there still is, you know, you're still having a control trial, you're still having a percentage that's audited, and you're still potentially having a second read by a human, but it could be used either for triage or to complement in terms of clinical outcomes around better quality. I think that's that's where in time it could be helpful. More so, and the data shows it, it also gets segmented by tenure between younger radiologists where it's helpful to them versus more seasoned, you know, trained individuals like yourself where it may be less valuable to you. If anything, may even, you know, slow you down or distract you. And I think that's just really around how it's used around imaging. There's a lot of work that will evolve now around how it can be used, particularly as we move into better machine learning and open AI. And I'm always cautious about the latest, you know, catchphrase to throw around. But given how diverse healthcare is and how you will be in environments where clinicians have their own approach to things, particularly as we move into the open AI space, the ability to then start to move to non-standardized models so doctors can have it tailored to themselves, that's where the technology in the future will be far more useful. Because the challenge with it being relatively standardized is what works for you may not work for your colleague, may not work for the next colleague. And that's where the longitudinal piece of it, which comes out of generative AI, would be quite useful.
I think that's a really spot on point with that. I think tailoring it for the individual radiologist is what's going to make the adoption of it by a lot of radiologists even more so, so that we can, you know, pick and choose what we like about the AI. And that's a work in progress, I think it's fair to
and,
say.
And that is because up until now, while we call it AI, artificial intelligence, a large part of it is big data coded algorithms. And the element to self-learn, teach, and continuously update, which means it gets tailored and refined, hasn't necessarily gotten to the maturity it needs to be. We've seen it explode in the last 9 months, but it still isn't there. And as you get there, then templating will become personalized. The things you want it to look for, because it'll look at, here's what it read on your behalf, here's where you accepted or didn't accept and correct, and it'll start to self-learn towards you personally. And that the technology is there, its application hasn't been built yet. It'll come soon.
Okay. Well, we'll watch that space for that, because I think that's when it will become game-changing for a lot of people. Leading on from that, Christian, the next 10, 15 years are going to be exciting times, I think, for radiology, and it's probably tied in with the AI. But there's also probably going to be challenges. So can I ask you, as someone who is obviously leading in this area, what do you see as the greatest challenges that we face in radiology in the next decade and some of the potential opportunities?
I think let me start with the challenges and then work towards the opportunities. I think the challenges are fewfold. The most obvious is the critical shortage we have of trained clinicians in terms of radiologists, but also in terms of other clinical skills. If we think, you know, particularly right now in Australia, but in other parts of the world, it might be different in terms of sonographers, nuke med techs. But there's certain technical skills that we know there's a shortage of. Radiologists, that we know globally, there's a shortage of. So that in itself provides a real challenge in terms of deploying clinicians there where the patient is and, you know, interacting with them, because a fair bit of the work goes beyond just reading off the images and scans, and it is interacting with the patient and it is interventional work, etc. And that's not going to change. And so that will be a critical need. Excuse me. Sorry. Yeah. That will be a critical need for us, and probably the biggest challenge, not just in Australia, but on a global level. I think the second, potentially in the short to medium term, is scope of work. And as you see in different countries, the definitions of what is done in radiology or by a radiologist or by other subspecialists, and whether that's cardiology or orthopedics, et cetera, or neurologists, there's definitely an evolving blurring of the lines at different speeds in different countries. And now, again, depending on how you look at it, you could, you know, that potentially is or isn't a challenge. My view is there's a reason, there's a clinical skill and there's a college and there's a standard of care that comes with the radiologist. And so making sure that how that's managed is important, so that, you know, if we're patient first, it's done in a way that clinical quality is okay. not to take away from the role of task shifting, but you know, it's more just you run the risk that if it's not treated thoughtfully, you commoditize the exceptionally high skills that radiologists have mm-hmm. when it starts to get moved into other specialist functions. And so that's the second. I think the third for me is actually going to be around a cost to serve, given what it costs, because we're big CapEx businesses, human resource, people intensive, doctor intensive. And so it does mean the cost of radiology is going to go up and up. And given I said, for me, access and affordability is a big deal, it worries me because I want to, for me, ideally, if I had a magic wand, you know, I'd love people to all be able to access good quality healthcare, irrespective of their socioeconomic circumstance. That's something I need to think about. I think the opportunities for me are then the inverse of that, which is there is a role, if carefully, thoughtfully, and respectfully implemented, there is a role for technology, there is a role for data analytics, there is a role for better use of how we're thinking about redistribution of scarce resources without, you know, upsetting the way radiology has been practiced, and that needs to be slowly and carefully implemented to try and offset a few of these, because it could fundamentally influence access to care, particularly as you think more regional healthcare, remote healthcare, and underserved communities, and it could fundamentally shift the cost point at which we serve, which makes it more affordable and accessible to people. The innovation side I'm intrigued by, because I do think what we've not done yet is enough thinking around collaboration between radiology and pathology and other aspects. To go back to that earlier question where you said without radiology, you know, it's fundamental to the health system. You know, for me, yeah. Radiology and pathology together, we've underinvested in how much, if we brought those data sets together, we can get earlier and better prediction of clinical outcomes, both for chronic disease management, but also for inpatient care. You know, I'm convinced in an analytical sense, our ability to earlier identify adverse events will improve as the data quality and the integration of these data sets allows these kind of algorithms to do better prediction.
Look, I think that for me as a radiologist, when I have any junior radiologists or junior trainees ask me, what do I think is the future for them in radiology? And I make it quite clear to them that I think there's a paradigm shift in what radiologists are expected to do. Now, they'll still be doing the bread and butter stuff, but you need to be able to tie in a certain educational and research element into your clinical practice. And you have to be able to bring in, as you said, the radiology with the pathology to prognosticate tumors. You know, these are all things that we can't see, but radiomics and AI will be able to teach us. So I think there's going to be that definite shift for what radiologists and trainees need to be doing in 10 years from now. But there's a lot of opportunities with that.
You know, I also think we often constrain it when we refer to it as diagnostic imaging, because radiology will absolutely, and it has in some certain areas already moved into therapeutic aspects of care. And so as we think about precision medicine, integrated care, and theranostics in that space, it will move to a space where when the patient's on the table and we're imaging them, not only are we identifying and diagnosing disease, but we're also doing curative procedures. And so my intuitive sense is that will grow beyond the space which is it's limited now, which is oncology.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how this evolves. Just to change the topic a little bit now, I have read that a young Shrey Varana once wanted to represent Manchester United and drive Ferraris for a living, but instead followed a path into medicine. If you hadn't been a doctor and then CEO in healthcare, what would you have liked to have been in terms of an alternative career?
That's a great question. I mean, just as a point of clarity, because it might sound a little bit egotistical, arrogant to say drive Ferraris. I wanted to be a test driver for Ferrari. Right. And I wanted to help them in development of their cars. That was my dream job as a young boy, was I'd love to help build and design, which actually lends itself to the answer to your question, which is, if I hadn't gone into healthcare and hadn't, you know, become a doctor, I probably would have studied mechanical engineering or something in the automotive space. I have an absolute passion for building things and an absolute passion for cars. And I don't mean this in the sense of assets and collecting them, but as in the grease monkey sense of taking a wrench and getting stuck into it. That definitely is the other part of me. I hide it well behind a suit and a tie, but yeah, my happy face is tinkering in a car engine.
Yeah, and I've heard that. I do my research before these podcasts, and my little birdie told me that you're very much into detoxifying or relaxing through cars and motorsports. That actually leads me on to the next question. So you're predicting my questions here. I read a quote from you that said, "Nothing cleanses my head like a long drive and good music." May I ask what Shravananda likes to do apart from fixing up cars to relax?
You've definitely done your research, Rich. Well done to you on that. Beyond going for long drives in the early hours of the morning and listening to music, and by the way, I love all types of music, just in case you're going to ask me next what's my favorite genre. The other things I love doing is reading, and I love dabbling, and I use the word dabbling humbly because I don't know whether I'm any good at it, in terms of writing poetry. I find it an incredibly cathartic thing to do when I've got a lot going on in my head, to just sit down and just express myself through words. I think I'm close to enough of a compilation that if I was courageous enough, I could publish. But I haven't decided yet whether I'm emotionally ready for that scrutiny. But yeah, I've over the years, a fair bit of my thoughts and my life moments and my emotional moments have since been copied down onto paper or written down onto paper. Beyond that, I love, and we spoke about it just before the podcast started, I love running and cycling. I find it almost meditative, so I tend to do it only by myself. I know because everyone often asks me, why aren't you running in a club or riding with a group? But it's actually my really good quiet time. You know, just go out for a 3 or 4 hour bike ride or a 10 or 20K run. And I find that very helpful. And, you know, as I said to you, I've allowed myself to get lazy enough in the past while that now probably more a brisk walk than a run. But, yeah, that's also definitely that's for me very, very relaxing. It does require me to take all my measurements off because I used to do everything to a timer. And whether that was a Garmin on my hand or a Garmin on my bike, I've learned to just switch it off and listen to my body and run to it. And so that definitely for me is my relaxing time now.
Terrific. It's funny you mentioned the poetry because my little birdie actually mentioned that to me. And I actually fashioned the question for you, which will come up now pertaining to that. So we'll move on to that. So, Shrey, we always finish our podcast with what we call the magic minute. So it goes for a little bit longer than a minute, but this is where we find out about Shrey the person, okay, not Shrey the CEO or Shrey the medical doctor. We get to find out a little bit more about you and what makes you you. So if you're happy, we have two types of questions. We have the open-ended questions where feel free to answer in any way you want. And then we have the two choices or the binary questions, so two options. They're all above board, nothing under the belt or anything like that. But if you don't want to answer anything, please just say pass. All right. Let's get started. So we'll start off with the open-ended questions. Shrey, do you have a favorite movie or movies?
I would probably have to say movies. So I love watching. And I watch across the board. But if you said, Shrey, but force yourself to pick. If I had to force myself to pick one and only one, maybe Silver Linings Playbook. I really, really, that's one of those movies that still just stirs me. If you allowed me to pick two and it wasn't that one, and this will show diversity of interests, it's probably on the one hand, classic rom-com Notting Hill.
Right, okay.
On the other hand, it's classic teenage petrolhead in terms of Fast and Furious, but the second one. I feel as it's gotten into its series, it's become more an action movie and less about the cars. But yeah, either the first or the second Fast and Furious, maybe the second. and Notting Hill would be the two that would probably define my interests on two extremes.
I think a lot of people may not have predicted the Notting Hill. I mean, I think it's a terrific movie, but it's funny because that question, I always ask that question because you get to really find out about the interviewee. We've had various responses such as Star Wars, you know, a whole range of things. And for me, it's where you go to get away from your work and everything else, you know. And it defines what you like to be when you're not in that sort of busy environment. So very interesting to find that out. Do you have a favorite actor or actress? No one in particular. Now, some people do, some people don't. For example, me, I love Matt Damon. I think every movie that he produces or is in is just phenomenal. Not one of these sort of stars, but...
If you ask me to find an actor that I've always been, wow, I'm always amazed how underrated he is and how really I appreciate his movies, it would be John Cusack. Mm-hmm. You know, that would stand out for me. There's just something for me about him as an actor that I've gone, wow, didn't expect this to be as good as it is. So.
Yeah, he's a good actor too. Do you have a favorite book or genre of books that you like to read? You said that you like poetry, but any particular genre of books?
I'm going to out myself as a nerd now when I say I love reading biographies and books about business. So if I just even tell you the last three that I've read, it would have been the one recently, the story about Elizabeth Holmes. It actually fascinated me, that. And then the one I read before that was the AstraZeneca one about the development of the vaccine. I generally read that in biographies. I love reading biographies, but interestingly, politicians for some reason I find it fascinating to understand them, or not to presume I'd understand them from a biography, but at least to learn a bit more.
I don't think that's surprising. I'm actually very similar. I love to read biographies. I have an uncle in Sri Lanka where I was born, and he always has a go at me, says, you have to read beyond biographies to find out more about the world. And I say to him, I actually like to read books that teach me things. And then he gets furious at me because he says that stories teach you things. So, yeah.
I'm sure he's right. I've just never had the ability to enjoy fiction as much through a book. I will through the movies and things like that, but not so much through
books.
Book.
Yeah. Now, this is a very Australian question. Have you ever eaten Vegemite, and what do you think of it?
So I am now going to really embarrass myself because I love Vegemite.
Very good.
And apparently, in a way that might even upset a few of the people listening, apparently I eat it in a very non-Australian way. So my understanding is that it is a smear of butter and a thin smear of Vegemite on a piece of toast is what's the norm. I, even to call it a thick smattering would not do it justice, but I spread the Vegemite on really thick with no butter.
Oh.
And no butter. And I absolutely love it. No. Look, it's interesting because we had Marmite, which I had before, so I'm kind of used to the taste. So it didn't surprise me as much. What surprised me is how much it tends to put people off, the fact that I don't add butter and I don't put it quite thin. I actually put it off quite thick.
It's quite funny. When I did my fellowship in England many years ago now, I asked the director, who was an Antipodean Australian guy, what do you want me to bring? And he said, bring me 10 jars of Vegemite. And they were gone within a week, or not a week, but in a few weeks. So I think it's a very Australian thing. But once you have Vegemite, it's hard to get rid of.
Sure. Look, I also love strong flavors in general, and I cook with very strong flavors myself. So for me, it's right up my alley.
I also hear you're a fan of chocolates and desserts, particularly ice cream. Can I ask you what you think of Tim Tams?
I'm intrigued by it. It's a little sweeter maybe than the kind of typical, and I would say biscuit, if that's the right term. That's a typical biscuit that I would have gone for. My sons love it, and, you know, all of the flavors. But yeah, I enjoy one every now and then. It wouldn't be my go-to biscuit. Maybe just a little too sweet for me.
Okay. I hear you also love to travel and immerse yourself in different cultures. Do you have any particular place or places that are your place or you really love to travel to?
So as a theme, I generally love to travel to parts of the world that are just steeped in history. Because again, it's a bit like the conversation we had about reading. I just love learning about culture and I love learning about food. You know, and so those two, because food for me is a subset of culture. And so for me, those things I really enjoy. Europe's, and it's probably split because I really love Europe. And at the same time, I also always enjoy a number of the Asian countries because they just give you such a different experience. And it also, for me, constantly reminds us about the breadth of humanity on the planet and how different people live. You know, and I think that for me is a big deal. It's also important to me about teaching my children that, about just learning how all of us exist on the planet today. Because otherwise we can get sometimes lost in the bubble of the communities that we're in.
I was going to ask you this question, but you've already answered it. And that was that a little birdie tells me that you're a bit of a poet. And I was going to ask you, have you ever published? But you've just also indicated that you're thinking about it. So
I'm ready to, and I've even had it edited, so I'm close to. So I love writing. I think I figured out who your birdie is by the way. There's a really small set of people that I've let read it and I've shared it with for their thoughts. that's interesting. But yeah, I probably will at a point. I think I want to wait till I'm out of words, if that makes sense. Because then, you know, from a personal growth, development, catharsis point of view, I've kind of like expressed myself fully. And maybe there's also an element of when I feel, you know, and like you said, this is the human part of us, not just the titles, you know, that we assimilate through our careers. But, you know, when I'm emotionally ready and vulnerable enough, because you really are bearing your soul when you share things like your poetry. And it's not about a commercial thing or anything like that. It's only about if someone else reads it and is stirred by it, then it'll give me joy that it helps someone the way it helped me to write it.
Okay, we look forward to that. So that probably will be in the next year or two, won't it?
Thank you for putting me under pressure.
You can announce it tonight if you want.
How about when I am ready? I promise I'll pick up the phone and let you know. Okay. I'm getting closer.
Great. Now, I hear you also are a keen baker. You like to bake and to cook. Is that true?
Yes, sir. I love baking and I really enjoy cooking. Indeed. There's something about, and I'll differentiate it for you, because while I enjoy both, I think the reason I love baking a little more than cooking is my journey and experience with food has taught me that while we eat for pleasure, we also eat for, to some extent, for nutrition and for sustenance. Baking is never that. My journey has been that baking is always about an emotional journey. For most of us, it's because we want joy, and baking makes us, eating cake makes us happy. And for some people, it's about, you know, I'm eating because maybe I'm not as happy and it'll make me feel better. But for me, cakes is about an emotional experience only. You never eat a cake for nutritional value, you know? And so that's why I love baking, because it, for me, I associate it with the sense of joy and it, putting a smile on someone's face. You know, I've been told that I should stop staring at people and watching them eat when I bake. And the reason it is because I love seeing people smile. And for me, a cake that someone just takes a bite of, that's purely about indulgence, right? Which is what it is. And you see them smile and the joy they get from tasting something like that, that's just magic for me.
Yeah. So it's another way, another release for you, isn't it? The baking and the cooking.
It absolutely is. It's and I always say you only bake when you're happy, because I think it'll present itself in what you do. The okay. only risk when I share these things on these podcasts is then I get a bunch of people going, hey, why haven't you baked for me? So,
well, you should expect that now. There's quite a few things you might expect after this podcast. All good, though. So let's move on to the binary questions. Yes. So we have a few binary questions. So there's two choices here. Do you prefer beer or wine?
Wine.
Mm-hmm. Red or white?
White.
White. I okay, I would imagine you would
cringe me saying that, but white.
Right. A mild curry or a very spicy curry?
Very spicy curry.
Mm. And I actually hear this is more of an open-ended question here. I hear you're an excellent cook of curries, but you wing it, not from a recipe. From you. Where did you learn that from? Your mum or?
So I know this was binary, so it would be yes, would be first. So I'm yes. committing to the protocol. I learned cooking from my mum, and then for years I didn't cook. And then I've picked it up again in the last few. Mm-hmm. And so that's why people always laugh because, you know, often someone will go, I love that. And I go, oh, I'm so glad, but now I feel bad. And they go, why? I say, because I winged it. So if you ask me for the recipe or if you ask me to cook it again, I can't promise you it will taste the same. So that's a standing joke in our house, which is enjoy it today because who knows tomorrow, Dad.
That is a problem, isn't it, when you make something really good and you can't remember how you made it. And
there's a few that I'm remembering it. I just keep a mental memory of how I did it for a few of my go-tos. But in general, no, I will. It's like baking. You get a feel for it after a while, and you get a sense for let's just try this with something else. And it looks so far. People seem to like it, or they're just being really polite. I don't know. Somewhere in between.
Okay, going back to the binaries.
Yes.
Do you prefer MotoGP or Formula One? That's a tough one, isn't it?
MotoGP.
MotoGP. Oh, really? More so than Formula One? Okay.
It's just stayed more competitive.
Right.
I love Formula One, but it's not as exhilarating in terms of the likelihood of five or six people could win. Mm-hmm. Although Ducati is dominating right now. Sorry, I've taken away from binary. Let me stop.
Okay. Now, you've alluded to this question before. Vegemite or Marmite?
Ooh, Vegemite.
Vegemite. Okay. Beach holiday or skiing?
Beach holiday.
Beach holiday, yeah. Rugby or soccer? It's a tough one too, isn't it?
Soccer?
Mm-hmm. Soccer. Okay. I would answer it that way too. And just on the side, I'm very much looking forward to the English Premier League next year. We have an Australian manager as the head of Tottenham. So yeah, I think that's something very much to look forward to.
As of this week. I follow rugby union, I follow soccer, I follow rugby league, and I've learned to follow footy now that I've moved to Australia. So yeah, I love sport.
Mm-hmm. Okay, TikTok or Facebook?
Can I say neither?
You can say neither or pass.
Pass.
Okay. And I'm going to finish with the last question. Golden goose or replica?
Ooh, golden goose.
Golden goose. Okay. I think that will be a very nuanced question for a lot of people. But I actually researched and I asked my two birdies this particular one. And they said that you have to ask these two. And it's good to know that it's golden goose.
That was a tough choice for me, but yeah, on the margin, golden goose.
Golden goose. Dr. Shrey Rana, it's been an absolute pleasure interviewing you for the podcast. Thank you very much for giving us your insights into radiology, the future of radiology, giving us a little bit of information about your experiences and how you've managed to get to the place you have got to, and also providing that advice to people who would like to follow a similar path. It's been delightful also to get to know a little bit more about the Shrey Varana we don't know about, you know, the person that we don't see. So thank you very much for your time, and we very much look forward to staying in contact with you and hopefully sharing your experiences too in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Suresh. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. And most importantly, for the work you and the RAB team do, it's such an important journey that you guys are on and such an important contribution that, you know, I applaud you guys for that. And if we can support you further going forward, we look forward to that.
Thank you very much, Ray.
Bye for now.
Okay.
Please subscribe to the RABcast channel on your preferred podcast subscription service. And please consider leaving a rating and a comment to let us know what you thought of this episode. To find out more about Radiology Across Borders, visit our website at radiologyacrossborders.org and follow us on LinkedIn to stay up to date with the latest happenings at the charity. We hope to have you join us and look forward to our next episode.